Content note. This episode of So Many Books, So Little Time contains references to previous topics covered in chapters of Catch-22, including some of the less savory moments, however, in less detail.
Hey folks, Dave here.
Andrew.
And welcome to So Many Books,
So Little Time.
Please join us for the final chapter of Catch-22 by Joseph Heller, called The Osarium. So, I wonder what this chapter is going to be about. Could it be about our main character?
Maybe.
Yeah. Now, we did promise many moons ago that on this final episode, we would get right into the book because at the end, we want to go sequentially through the book. But before we do get into the book, I think we need to have a little conversation about what happened last time.
Yes. Well, we got all the details with the Snowden situation.
And what a situation.
Yes. I think we also had a bit of the hospital, the fact that Osarion was in hospital because he agreed to an odious agreement with Korn and Korn and Cathcart.
He agreed very to, odious.
Yeah, he agreed to be basically their PR man without, you know, yeah.
And he saved them from a Nazi assassin.
According to them, yes, except they've got who trusts these guys, man?
And I love that was what eventually... Well, that was what, when he's talking to the chaplain in the hospital, that's what made Osarion go, oh, I'm not going to go through with this. I mean, being their pal, that's one thing. Saying I saved their life, nope, that's too far.
It's a step too far because it was also related to something that he felt guilt about. I think it's interesting, Osarion, when he directly feels responsible for something, he doesn't want to give that away. That's his guilt. It's odd.
Like he owns that suffering. No one else can have this suffering.
Yeah.
I mean, we saw that with him being the only one that knew Snowden's secret. You know, I think he even told Dunbar, someone, that Snowden told him his secret when he died. And it's only when we've read the chapter that we've learned that it wasn't like a literal whisper in the ear. It was just a realization he came to.
Yeah. The absolute fragility of the human body, and that, you know, that once the spirit is gone, only flesh remains. It's interesting that he brought that up. That when you're gone, like there's something gone about you, then the only thing that remains is flesh. And I think, I wonder if how much of that has also been the reason he's been struggling, because he's been doling out death. And that already was affecting him, but now with that realization and that really confronting situation. Yeah, we had a lot of reflections on that last episode, if you haven't had a chance.
Yes, I do recommend it. It's a good listen, if I do say so myself. We put out good work.
Sometimes, yes.
It's also, I say this partly tongue-in-cheek, but there's some truth to it. It really is the strength of the material, you know. I believe the tagline of our podcast is we read books and react to them.
Yeah.
And the reaction is always based on the strength of the material. So,
yeah.
Actually, what I think, too, was in some of those early chapters of Northanger Abbey, I was kind of disengaged because I was waiting for kind of the book to get going. And once it did, I was kind of on board, but I feel maybe I wasn't giving my best in those episodes just because I wasn't engaging with the material.
I think, yeah, part of it is interacting with the material. Part of it is also we have dialogue and reflections. And it's interesting. Like, I think that we're not trying to be anything that we're not, if that makes sense, dear listeners. We just kind of let it out.
Oh, but you should marvel at our intelligence for loving reading and picking these great works that we will bestow knowledge upon those who listen to us. I am completely being sarcastic here.
That was very disingenuous, Dave. But yes, no, it's just...
No, well, I've said it before because, you know, one of your personality traits is the tendency to kind of always put caveats in front of, you know, I'm not an expert. Yeah. And sometimes I feel I have to catch you go, no, we are who we are. And part of this podcast is just reacting to this based on who we are. And that's why we constantly said, you know, if you and your friends and your own life experience out there, if you read or watch a movie or whatever you engage with and have conversations, obviously they will be unique and interesting based on your own passions, expertise, life experience. That's, you know, as a kind of main hobby, this podcast is my second main hobby, but you know, I make critique videos on video games and, I think, you know, sometimes when I'm talking about a game that everyone's talked about, I have that voice in my head, the imposter syndrome go, how are you ever going to be able to say something new or interesting about this game that's been discussed to death by people who you feel are far smarter than you? And I have to always squelch that voice and go, doesn't matter. I'm going to read and watch all those things those other people have made to kind of get a greater picture. And then I'm going to come at it from my own feelings and experience, and we'll see if anything comes of it. And often some interesting stuff happens.
I think the difference here is also, and we've talked about why I tend to use that caveat before. It's part of it is because I want to acknowledge that, like, well, that we're not experts. We are only experts in how we perceive something. And even then, we haven't necessarily dug into why we perceive things a certain way. Not always. Sometimes we go a little bit into, like, what's our underlying philosophy of life and how that maybe is playing or the influence, how we've been raised, our education, our environment. So we nod to these things, and I think that's important. I think there's a... the reason I do this, we talked about, is like there's a need... The difference between, for example, how you're doing your video game critiques is that you go and you find what the others have said, what some of the others have said that have background in this and have experience in this and also have some expertise in this area. And you listen to their things, and then you go and you still reflect and you see what are my insights, what's going on, what am I experiencing, and then you reflect on it. Whereas we're not necessarily going and looking up what other... So going in and studying the literature or studying how that's a whole thing that we don't do. And it's a lot more about the conversation, the reactions and responses. And I guess that's why I feel comfortable doing the caveat. And I do that in other things as well, because I think part of it is also acknowledging that I know that I could be 1,000% wrong in how I'm interpreting what the author meant. It's just what the impression that I'm getting. And I'm just one of us, you know, billions of people on this planet right now. And then the billions of people that preceded us.
I want to follow this thread, but I also said we would be getting into the book.
Yes.
The thing is that, and I've had discussions with friends about this. There's a concept known as death of the author. It was basically in response to the idea that, you know, the interpretation, what the author meant when they created the work, their word is law. It's like, that's the official meaning of a work. And death of the author, it was by Roland Barthes, who I think he was prominent in the 60s and 70s as, I believe he was a philosopher. Anyway, he wrote a lot, you know, and his point was, well, no, the author... You know, they die, their work lives on. And even if they did an interview talking about what they meant with the piece, that's they might not even know what really inspired the piece.
Yeah.
And then there's the idea that kind of morphed into my personal philosophy, where the author's perspective is important, but it is one interpretation. I will even go so far as to say maybe it's the most important one. I'm not completely convinced of that, but I can be I can see that as an argument, but basically, going back to, you know, you just being one of 7 billion people, you know, that's the value, the unique perspective we all bring to.
And it doesn't, I don't think it devalues by having that caveat. I think it's more, I want to be respectful to the fact that there will be other ways of seeing this, and I acknowledge that. And I think that that's important, because otherwise, every time we say something or do anything in our lives, it's as though we're navigating the world where we think we are the most important thing ever, and we are unable to learn and hear from other perspectives. Whereas I'm like, dang, I want to hear other perspectives. I want to learn. It might not change my perspective, but I'd like to know what these other perspectives are and where they've, how they've arisen. One big thing, I don't know if I mentioned this last week, but the study group that I, one of the study things that I do is exploring like deeper layers, the purpose of education and so on and so forth. And one thing that came up, which was interesting, was the concept of false objectivity, that there is where you think you're being objective, but unless you truly examine what is influencing how you are perceiving things, and you're engaging in contextual analysis. You're going, analysis is one thing. There's easy ways to identify if you have biases. But when it comes to when you're exploring things that have to do with social interactions, or why do people behave this way, or what is meant when they do this, and that kind of thing, when we don't acknowledge our cultural, our conventional, like what we consider conventional, what isn't, so our environmental effect, and also our personal opinions and feelings on things, and how that can influence how we perceive things, then we're being there's that false objectivity that that's a danger.
I mean, maybe this is a radical notion, but for a long time now I've been of the mind that there is no such thing as objectivity when approaching a work, let's put it that way.
But I think that's the difference. Yeah, no, you're right. We are going off track.
Putting my foot down. Here's the funny thing. I was looking at our timer when you were talking about this originally and go, okay, it's about 8 minutes, 30 seconds. I'll wait till we get to a 10, and then boom, we'll get into the book. And then I started talking, and then you started talking. And now
this is the danger.
It's almost 14 minutes. So,
we're wrapping it up.
Look, okay, if you're a long-time listener of this podcast, when you heard me say we're going to get right into it, you probably laughed, and you were right to do so.
I believe we've started some sort of drinking game, whether your thing be non-alcoholic beverages like soda or not, that says, well, we need to mention the weather at least once in our podcast. Yes, it's hot, it's humid, we're getting into summer, it's horrible. We have to mention, I think we've mentioned this previously on a podcast, previous episode, when we read 1984, reference to a previous book. Well, we had that, so that happened before.
And then getting off topic.
And we need to make a meme that just says the things that we keep saying in our podcast.
I'm sure one day we will have a poor fan who will go through and tally all.
No, please don't do this to yourself.
No one ever do that. That is madness. Anyway.
Unless this is the kind of thing that is your jam, please don't.
So, shall we get into the final chapter of Catch-22? I was about to say 1984, but no, this is the final chapter of Catch-22.
Well, it's got a number in the title, too, so fair. It's a fair mix-up.
Let's do this. Chapter 42, Yessarian. Colonel Korn says, said Major Danby to Yessarian with a prissy, gratified smile, that the deal is still on. Everything is working out fine. No, it isn't. Oh, yes, indeed, Major Danby insisted benevolently. In fact, everything is much better. It was really a stroke of luck that you were almost murdered by that girl. Now the deal can go through perfectly. I'm not making any deals with Colonel Korn. Major Danby's effervescent optimism vanished instantly, and he broke out all at once into a bubbling sweat. But you do have a deal with him, don't you? He asked in anguished puzzlement. Don't you have an agreement? I am breaking the agreement. But you shook hands on it, didn't you? You gave him your word as a gentleman. I'm breaking my word. Oh dear, sighed Major Danby, and began dabbing ineffectually at his careworn brow with a folded white handkerchief. But why, Yessarian? It's a very good deal they're offering you. It's a lousy deal, Danby. It's an odious deal. Oh dear, Major Danby fretted. running his bare hand over his dark, wiry hair, which was already soaked with perspiration to the tops of thick, close-cropped waves. Oh, dear. Danby, don't you think it's odious? Major Danby pondered a moment. Yes, I suppose it is odious, he conceded with reluctance. His globular, exophthalmic eyes were quite distraught. But why did you make such a deal if you didn't like it? I did it in a moment of weakness, Yusarian wisecracked with glum irony. I was trying to save my life. Don't you want to save your life now? That's why I won't let them make me fly more missions. Then let them send you home and you'll be in no more danger. Let them send me home because I flew more than 50 missions, Yusarian said, and not because I was stabbed by that girl, or because I've turned into such a stubborn son of a bitch. Major Danby shook his head emphatically in sincere and bespeckled vexation. They'd have to send nearly every man home if they did that. Most of the men have more than 50 missions. Colonel Cathcart couldn't possibly requisition so many inexperienced replacement crews at one time without causing an investigation. He's caught in his own trap. That's his problem. No, Yusarian, Major Danby disagreed solicitously. It's your problem, because if you don't go through with the deal, they're going to institute court-martial proceedings as soon as you sign out of the hospital. Yusarian thumbed his nose at Major Danby and laughed with smug elation. The hell they will! Don't lie to me, Danby. They wouldn't even try. But why wouldn't they? Inquired Major Danby, blinking with astonishment. Because I've really got them over a barrel now. There's an official report that says I was stabbed by a Nazi assassin trying to kill them. They'd certainly look silly trying to court-martial me after that. But Yusarian, Major Danby exclaimed, there's another official report that says you were stabbed by an innocent girl in the course of extensive black market operations involving acts of sabotage and the sale of military secrets to the enemy. Yusarian was taken back severely with surprise and disappointment. Another official report? Yusarian, they can prepare as many official reports as they want and choose whichever ones they need on any given occasion. Didn't you know that? Oh dear, Yusarian murmured in heavy dejection, the blood draining from his face. Oh dear. Major Danby pressed forward avidly with a look of vulturous well-meaning. Yusarian, do what they want and let them send you home. It's the best for everyone that way. It's best for Cathcart, Korn, and me, not for everyone. For everyone, Major Danby insisted. It will solve the whole problem. Is it best for the men in the group who will have to keep flying more missions? Major Danby flinched and turned his face away uncomfortably for a second. Yusarian, he replied, it will help nobody if you force Colonel Cathcart to court-martial you and prove you guilty of all the crimes with which you'll be charged. You will go to prison for a long time and your whole life will be ruined. Yusarian listened to him with a growing feeling of concern. What crimes will they charge me with? Incompetence over Ferreira? Insubordination? Refusal to engage the enemy in combat when ordered to do so? And desertion? Yusarian sucked his cheeks in soberly. They could charge me with all that, could they? They gave me a medal for Ferreira. How could they charge me with incompetence now? Arfi will swear that you and McWatt lied in your official report. I'll bet the bastard would. They will also find you guilty, Major Danby recited, of rape, extensive black market operations, acts of sabotage, and the sale of military secrets to the enemy. How will they prove any of that? I never did a single one of those things. But they have witnesses who will swear you did. They can get all the witnesses they need simply by persuading them that destroying you is for the good of the country. And in a way, it would be for the good of the country.
If you go back, Arfi is obviously involved.
Mm.
But incompetence of Ferreira, that was Arfi. Insubordination, that was technically someone else. There's a bunch of them, actually. Refusal to engage the enemy in combat when ordered to do so, that would be Dunbar. Desertion, or, right?
Well, or got officially shot down.
Yeah, but we decided, like, I think we agreed that was a bit sus.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, I'm fully convinced he's out there alive.
Yeah. There's way too much, susness. McWatt, I guess, could be in subordination because he kept flying really, shouldn't have been doing what he was doing. Rape, that's Arfi. Extensive black market operations, that's Myla. Acts of sabotage, I mean, technically Myla. And sale of military secrets to the enemy, probably also Myla.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah.
And Myla will instantly be a witness saying that Yusarian was guilty of all this.
Yeah.
But the point that Dandy's making here is that they could persuade almost anyone in the group
to
talk on him for the good of the country. And as he's about to say, it would be for the good of the country.
Yeah.
In what way, Yusarian demanded, rising up slowly on one elbow with bridling hostility. Major Danby drew back a bit and began mopping his forehead again. Well, Yusarian, he began with an apologetic stammer, it would not help the war effort to bring Colonel Cathcart and Colonel Korn into disrepute now. Let's face it, Yusarian, in spite of everything, the group does have a very good record. If you were court-martialed and found innocent, other men would probably refuse to fly missions too. Colonel Cathcart would be in disgrace, and the military efficiency of the unit might be destroyed. So in that way, it would be for the good of the country to have you found guilty and put in prison, even though you are innocent. What a sweet way you have of putting things, Yusarian snapped with caustic resentment. Major Danby turned red and squirmed and squinted uneasily. Please don't blame me, he pleaded with a look of anxious integrity. You know it's not my fault. All I'm doing is trying to look at things objectively and arrive at a solution to a very difficult situation. I didn't create the situation, but you can resolve it. Now, what else can you do? You don't want to fly more missions. I can run away. Run away? Desert. Take off. I can turn my back on the whole damn mess and start running. Major Danby was shocked. Where to? Where could you go? I can get to Rome easily enough, and I could hide myself there. And live in danger every minute of your life that they would find you? No, Yusarian. That would be a disastrous and ignoble thing to do. Running away from problems never solve them. Please believe me, I am only trying to help you. That's what that kind detective said before he decided to jab his thumb into my wound, Yusarian retorted sarcastically. I am not a detective, Major Danby replied with indignation, his cheeks flushing again. I am a university professor with a highly developed sense of right and wrong, and I wouldn't try to deceive you. I wouldn't lie to anyone. What would you do if one of the men in the group asked you about this conversation? I would lie to him. Yusarian laughed mockingly, and Major Danby, despite his blushing discomfort, leaned back with relief, as though welcoming the respite Yusarian's changing mood promised. Yusarian gazed at him with a mixture of reserved pity and contempt. He sat up in bed with his back resting against the headboard, lit a cigarette, smiled slightly with wry amusement, and stared with whimsical sympathy at the vivid, pop-eyed horror that had implanted itself permanently on Major Danby's face the day of the mission to Evkenland, when General Dreidel had ordered him taken outside and shot. The startled wrinkles would always remain, like deep back scars, and the Yusarian felt sorry for the gentle, moral, middle-aged idealist, as he felt sorry for so many people whose shortcomings were not large and whose troubles were light. With deliberate amiability, he said, Danby, how can you work along with people like Cathcart and Korn? Doesn't it turn your stomach? Major Danby seemed surprised by Yusarian's question. I do it to help my country, he replied, as though the answer should have been obvious. Colonel Cathcart and Colonel Korn are my superiors, and obeying their orders is the only contribution I can make to the war effort. I work along with them because it's my duty, and also, he added in a much lower voice, dropping his eyes, because I am not a very aggressive person. Your country doesn't need your help anymore, Yusarian reasoned with antagonism, so all you're doing is helping them. I try not to think of that, Major Danby admitted frankly, but I try to concentrate on only the big result and to forget that they are succeeding too. I try to pretend that they are not significant. That's my trouble, you know, Yusarian mused sympathetically, folding his arms. Between me and every ideal, I always find Scheisskopfs, Peckhams, Korns, and Cathcarts, and that sort of changes the ideal. You must try not to think of them, Major Danby advised affirmatively, and you must never let them change your values. Ideals are good, but people are sometimes not so good. You must try to look up at the big picture. Yusarian rejected the advice with a skeptical shake of his head. When I look up, I see people cashing in. I don't see heaven or saints or angels. I see people cashing in on every decent impulse and every human tragedy. But you must try not to think of that, Major Danby insisted, and you must try not to let it upset you. Oh, it doesn't really upset me. What does upset me, though, is that they think I'm a sucker. They think that they're smart and the rest of us are dumb, And you know, Danby, the thought occurs to me right now for the first time that maybe they're right. But you must try not to think of that too, argued Major Danby. You must think only of the welfare of your country and the dignity of man. Yeah, said Yusarian. I mean it, Yusarian. This is not World War I. You must never forget that we're at war with aggressors who would not let either one of us live if they won. I know that, Yusarian replied tersely with a sudden
Going back for a second, I wonder why. I don't know. I can't remember what Danby was or looked like.
Yeah, really. Yeah. I can't remember if they described him.
I'm wondering if there's a reason. Because Yusarian, obvious.
Mm.
But we'll find out. Yes, that's weird.
I know that, Yusarian replied tersely with a sudden surge of scowling annoyance. Christ, Danby, I earned that medal I got. No matter what their reasons were for giving it to me, I've flown 70 goddamn combat missions. Don't talk to me about fighting to save my country. I've been fighting all along to save my country. Now I'm going to fight a little to save myself. The country's not in danger anymore, but I am. The war's not over yet. The Germans are driving toward Antwerp. The Germans will be beaten in a few months. Japan will be beaten a few months after that. If I were to give up my life now, it wouldn't be for my country. It would be for Cathcart and Korn. So I'm turning my bomb sight in for the duration. From now on, I'm thinking only of me. Major Danby replied indulgently with a superior smile. But Yusarian, suppose everyone felt that way. Then I'd certainly be a damn fool to feel any other way, wouldn't I? Yusarian sat up straighter with a quizzical expression. You know, I have a queer feeling that I've been through this exact conversation before with someone. It's just like the chaplain's sensation of having experienced everything twice. The chaplain wants you to let them send you home, Major Danby remarked. The chaplain can jump in the lake. Oh dear, Major Danby sighed, shaking his head in regretful disappointment. He's afraid he might have influenced you. He didn't influence me. You know what I might do? I might stay right here in this hospital bed and vegetate. I could vegetate very comfortably right here and let other people make the decisions. You must make decisions, Major Danby disagreed. A person can't live like a vegetable. Why not? A distant, warm look entered Major Danby's eyes. It must be nice to live like a vegetable, he conceded wistfully. It's lousy, answered the Yusarian. No, it must be very pleasant to be free from all this doubt and pressure, insisted Major Danby. I think I'd like to live like a vegetable and make no important decisions. What kind of vegetable, Danby? A cucumber or a carrot? What kind of cucumber? A good one or a bad one? Oh, a good one, of course. They'd cut you off in your prime and slice you up for a salad. Major Danby's face fell. Poor one, then. They'd let you rot and use you for fertilizer to help the good ones grow. I guess I don't want to live like a vegetable, then, said Major Danby with a smile of sad resignation. Danby, must I really let them send me home? Yusarian inquired of him seriously. Major Danby shrugged. It's a way to save yourself. It's a way to lose myself, Danby. You ought to know that. You could have lots of things you want. I don't want lots of things I want, Yusarian replied, and then beat his fist down against the mattress in an outburst of rage and frustration. God damn it, Danby. I've got friends who were killed in this war. I can't make a deal now. Getting stabbed by that bitch was the best thing that ever happened to me. Would you rather go to jail? Would you let them send you home? Of course I would, Major Danby declared with conviction. Certainly I would, he added a few moments later in a less positive manner. Yes, I suppose I would let them send me home if I were in your place, he decided uncomfortably after lapsing into troubled contemplation. Then he threw his face sideways disgustedly in a gesture of violent distress and blurted out, Oh yes, of course I'd let them send me home, but I'm such a terrible coward I couldn't really be in your place. But suppose you weren't a coward, Yusarian demanded, studying him closely. Suppose you did have the courage to defy somebody. Then I wouldn't let them send me home, Major Danby vowed emphatically with vigorous joy and enthusiasm. But I certainly wouldn't let them court-martial me. Would you fly more missions? No, of course not. That would be total capitulation. And I might be killed. Then you'd run away. Major Danby started to retort with proud spirit and came to an abrupt stop, his half-open jaw swinging closed dumbly. He pursed his lips in a tired pout. I guess there just wouldn't be any hope for me then, would there? His forehead and protuberant white eyeballs were soon glistening nervously again. He crossed his limp wrists in his lap and hardly seemed to be breathing as he sat with his gaze drooping toward the floor in acquiescent defeat. Dark, steep shadows slanted in from the window. The Assyrian watched him solemnly, and neither of the two men stirred at the rattling noise of a speeding vehicle skidding to a stop outside and the sound of racing footsteps pounding toward the building in haste. "Yes, there is hope for you," Yessarian remembered with a sluggish flow of inspiration. "Milo might help you. He's bigger than Colonel Cathcart, and he owes me a few favors." Major Danby shook his head and answered tonelessly, "Milo and Colonel Cathcart are pals now. He made Colonel Cathcart a vice president and promised him an important job after the war." "Then XPFC Wintergreen will help us," Yessarian exclaimed. "He hates them both, and this will infuriate him." Major Danby shook his head bleakly again. "Milo and XPFC Wintergreen merged last week. They're all partners now in M&M Enterprises. Then there is no hope for us, is there?" "No hope. No hope at all, is there?" "No, no hope at all," Major Danby conceded. He looked up after a while with a half-formed notion. "Wouldn't it be nice if they could disappear us the way they disappeared the others and relieve us of all these crushing burdens?" Yessarian said no. Major Danby agreed with a melancholy nod, lowering his eyes again, and there was no hope at all for either of them until footsteps exploded in the corridor suddenly, and the chaplain, shouting at the top of his voice, came bursting into the room with the electrifying news about war. So overcome with hilarious excitement that he was almost incoherent for a minute or two, tears of great elation were sparkling in his eyes, and the Assyrian leaped out of bed with an incredulous yelp when he finally understood. "Sweden!" he cried. "Or!" cried the chaplain. "Or!" cried the Assyrian. "Sweden!" cried the chaplain, shaking his head up and down with gleeful rapture and prancing about uncontrollably from spot to spot in a grinning, delicious frenzy. "It's a miracle, I tell you, a miracle. I believe in God again, I really do. Washed ashore in Sweden after so many weeks at sea. It's a miracle." "Washed ashore, hell!" the Assyrian declared, jumping all about also and roaring in laughing exultation at the walls, the ceiling, the chaplain, and Major Danby. "He didn't wash ashore in Sweden. He rode there. He rode there, chaplain. He rode there." "Rode there? He planned it that way. He went to Sweden deliberately." "Well, I don't care," the chaplain flung back with undiminished zeal. "It's still a miracle of human intelligence and human endurance. Look how much he accomplished." The chaplain clutched his head with both hands and doubled over in laughter. "Can't you just picture him?" he exclaimed with amazement. "Can't you just picture him in that yellow raft, paddling through the Straits of Gibraltar at night with that tiny little blue oar, with that fishing line trailing out behind him, eating raw codfish all the way to Sweden, and serving himself tea every afternoon?" "I can just see him," cried the chaplain, pausing a moment in his celebration to catch his breath. "It's a miracle of human perseverance, I tell you. And that's just what I'm going to do from now on. I'm going to persevere. Yes, I'm going to persevere." He knew what he was doing every step of the way, Yessarian rejoiced, holding both fists aloft triumphantly, as though hoping to squeeze revelations from them. He spun to a stop, facing Major Danby. "Danby, you dope, there is hope after all. Can't you see? Even Clevenger might be alive somewhere in that cloud of his, hiding inside until it's safe to come out." "What are you talking about?" Major Danby asked in confusion. "What are you both talking about?" "Bring me apples, Danby, and chestnuts, too. Run, Danby, run. Bring me crab apples and horse chestnuts before it's too late, and get some for yourself." "Horse chestnuts? Crab apples? What in the world for?" "To pop into our cheeks, of course." Yessarian threw his arms up into the air in a gesture of mighty and despairing self-recrimination. "Oh, why didn't I listen to him? Why wouldn't I have some faith?" "Have you gone crazy?" Major Danby demanded with alarm and bewilderment. "Yessarian, will you please tell me what you are talking about?" "Danby, Orr planned it this way. Don't you understand? He planned it that way from the beginning. He even practiced getting shot down. He rehearsed for it on every mission he flew. And I wouldn't go with him. Oh, why wouldn't I listen? He invited me along, and I wouldn't go with him. Danby, bring me buck teeth too, and a valve to fix, and a look of stupid innocence that nobody would ever suspect of any cleverness. I'll need them all. Oh, why wouldn't I listen to him? Now I understand what he was trying to tell me. I even understand why that girl was hitting him on the head with her shoe." "Why?" inquired the chaplain sharply. Yessarian whirled and seized the chaplain by the shirt front in an importuning grip. "Chaplain, help me. Please help me. Get my clothes and hurry, will you? I need them right away." The chaplain started away alertly. "Yes, Yessarian, I will. But where are they? How will I get them?" "By bullying and browbeating anyone who tries to stop you. Chaplain, get me my uniform. It's around this hospital somewhere. For once in your life, succeed at something. The chaplain straightened his shoulders with determination and tightened his jaw. Don't worry, Yessarian, I'll get your uniform. But why was that girl hitting Orr over the head with her shoe? Please tell me. Because he was paying her to, that's why. But she wouldn't hit him hard enough, so he had to row to Sweden. Chaplain, find me my uniform so I can get out of here. Ask Nurse Duckett for it. She'll help you. She'll do anything she can to be rid of me. Where are you going? Major Danby asked apprehensively when the chaplain had shot from the room. What are you going to do? I'm going to run away, Yessarian announced in an exuberant, clear voice, already tearing open the buttons of his pajama top. Oh, no, Major Danby groaned and began patting his perspiring face rapidly with the bare palms of both hands. You can't run away. Where can you run to? Where can you go? To Sweden. To Sweden? Major Danby exclaimed in astonishment. You're going to run to Sweden? Are you crazy? Or did it? Oh, no, Major Danby pleaded. No, Yessarian, you'll never get there. You can't run away to Sweden. You can't even row. But I can get to Rome if you'll keep your mouth shut when you leave here and give me a chance to catch a ride. Will you do it? But they'll find you, Major Danby argued desperately, and bring you back and punish you even more severely. They'll have to try like hell to catch me this time. They will try like hell. And even if they don't find you, what kind of way is that to live? You'll always be alone. No one will ever be on your side, and you'll always live in danger of betrayal. I live that way now. But you can't just turn your back on all your responsibilities and run away from them, Major Danby insisted. It's such a negative move. It's escapist. Yessarian laughed with buoyant scorn and shook his head. I'm not running away from my responsibilities. I'm running to them. There's nothing negative about running away to save my life. You know who the escapists are, don't you, Danby? Not me and Orr. Chaplain, please talk to him, will you? He's deserting. He wants to run away to Sweden. Wonderful, cheered the chaplain, proudly throwing on the bed a pillowcase full of Yessarian's clothing. Run away to Sweden, Yessarian, and I'll stay here and persevere. Yes, I'll persevere. I'll nag and badger Colonel Cathcart and Colonel Korn every time I see them. I'm not afraid. I'll even pick on General Dreidel. General Dreidel's out, Yessarian reminded, pulling on his trousers and hastily stuffing the tails of his shirt inside. It's General Peckham now. The chaplain's babbling confidence did not falter for an instant. Then I'll pick on General Peckham and even on General Shyskov. And do you know what else I'm going to do? I'm going to punch Captain Black in the nose the very next time I see him. Yes, I'm going to punch him in the nose. I'll do it when lots of people are around so that he may not have a chance to hit me back. Have you both gone crazy? Major Danby protested, his bulging eyes straining in their sockets with tortured awe and exasperation. Have you both taken leave of your senses? Yessarian, listen. It's a miracle, I tell you, the chaplain proclaimed, seizing Major Danby about the waist and dancing him around with his elbows extended for a waltz. A real miracle. If Orr could row to Sweden, then I can triumph over Colonel Cathcart and Colonel Korn. If only I persevere. Chaplain, will you please shut up? Major Danby entreated politely, pulling free and patting his perspiring brow with a fluttering motion. He bent toward Yessarian, who was reaching for his shoes. What about Colonel? I couldn't care less, but this may act to hell with them both. This may actually help them, Major Danby persisted stubbornly. Have you thought of that? Let the bastards thrive for all I care, since I can't do a thing to stop them but embarrass them by running away. I've got responsibilities of my own now, Danby. I've got to get to Sweden. You'll never make it. It's impossible. It's almost a geographical impossibility to get there from here. Hell, Danby, I know that, but at least I'll be trying. There's a young kid in Rome whose life I'd like to save if I can find her. I'll take her to Sweden with me if I can find her. So it isn't all selfish, is it? It's absolutely insane. Your conscience will never let you rest. God bless it, the Assyrian laughed. I wouldn't want to live without strong misgivings, right, Chaplain? I'm going to punch Captain Black right in the nose the next time I see him, roared the chaplain, throwing two left jabs in the air, and then a clumsy haymaker, just like that. What about the disgrace? Demanded Major Danby. What disgrace? I'm more in disgrace now. Yessarian tied a hard knot in his second shoelace and sprang to his feet. Well, Danby, I'm ready. What do you say? Will you keep your mouth shut and let me catch a ride? Major Danby regarded the Yessarian in silence with a strange, sad smile. He had stopped sweating and seemed absolutely calm. What would you do if I did try to stop you? He asked with rueful mockery. Beat me up? Yessarian reacted to that question with hurt surprise. No, of course not. Why do you say that? "I will beat you up," boasted the chaplain, dancing up very close to Major Danby and shadowboxing. "You and Captain Black, and maybe even Corporal Whitcomb. Wouldn't it be wonderful if I found I didn't have to be afraid of Corporal Whitcomb anymore?" "Are you going to stop me?" the assailant asked Major Danby, and gazed at him steadily. Major Danby skipped away from the chaplain and hesitated a moment longer. "No, of course not," he blurted out, and suddenly was waving both arms toward the door in a gesture of exuberant urgency. "Of course I won't stop you. Go, for God's sakes, and hurry. Do you need any money?" "I have some money." "Well, here's some more." With fervent, excited enthusiasm, Major Danby pressed a thick wad of Italian currency upon the Assyrian and clasped his hand in both his own, as much to still his own trembling fingers as to give encouragement to the Assyrian. "It must be nice to be in Sweden now," he observed yearningly. "The girls are so sweet, and the people are so advanced." "Goodbye, Yessarian," the chaplain called, "and good luck. I'll stay here and persevere, and we'll meet again when the fighting stops." "So long, chaplain." "Thanks, Danby. How do you feel, Yessarian?" "Fine. No, I'm very frightened." "That's good," said Major Danby. "It proves you're still alive." "It won't be fun." Yessarian started out. "Yes, it will. I mean it, Yessarian. You'll have to keep on your toes every minute of every day. They'll bend heaven and earth to catch you." "I'll keep on my toes every minute." "You'll have to jump." "I'll jump." "Jump!" Major Danby cried. Yessarian jumped. Natalie's was hiding just outside the door. The knife came down, missing him by inches, and he took off. The end. I forgot how uplifting that final chapter is.
It is, and at the same time, given Milo's influence and how Quorn and Cathcart and all of them are involved in it.
Oh yeah, no, the chance of Yessarian getting away is pretty bleak.
Yeah.
But he's overcome his, like, spiritual problem.
Yeah, that's true. He's like, nope, need to get the hell out of here.
Heck, I mean, the chaplain had his faith renewed.
That's true.
And it's interesting, we really haven't had much time with Major Danby, but, like, I came to like him in that last chapter.
I think also Danby is a prime example of someone who's just been continuously a victim of abuse as well.
He seems a little like Clevenger, where, you know, he kept trying to persuade the Assyrian that, look, I'm with you all the way with the stupidity of my superiors and how unjust everything is, but look at the big picture. And the sad thing was, even that was kind of on flimsy pretenses, because as Yessarian pointed out, look, America's winning the war. Germany and Japan are going to fold soon. Yeah. There's no point in me dying.
Yeah. This is interesting. But yeah, it's very interesting. But okay, so we've got...
Yes. See, it's not about discussing the chapter. Rue's gone right to the
top. No, timeline. I want to understand this. For me, I'm trying to figure out what the heck is going on.
You've been waiting the whole book to do this.
It's so driving
I'm
me up
not,
the wall.
I'm not really making fun of you. I'm just pointing out how...
Yeah. It's just, yeah. Okay, so I found something, which is a Prezi on this, done by Taylor Kellerman, and I suspect it was for a school assignment. Okay. So, starting with that. Event number one. Yessarian is stationed in Colorado, meets Wintergreen, discovers the hospital. The soldier who saw everything twice. So, this is... we'll move on. So, this is the whole... The doctor told Yessarian to fake a liver disease rather than appendicitis. And the whole Giuseppe thing. And the loss of their loved ones and that sentimental moment he knew he would never have with his own family. And I think something about that is because they haven't gone into it, but I think he doesn't have family. That's why. Mm. So, Major's promoted. He was promoted. Yeah, that's the next thing that happens. So, in sequence of events. Yessarian Cadet School in Santa Ana spends Thanksgiving in the hospital. So... He broke the sacred oath. Instead of being in the hospital, he spent time with her, and they're talking about God. Yeah?
That's then, right. Yes. Shazkoth's wife kept wanting to ask Yessarian about talk about God, not ask him that.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, and he was... This is the whole affairs business of... Huh. This is interesting. They're saying that they suspect that Lieutenant Shaiskov's wife, a lot of people argued that it's actually the same person as Dory does.
Oh, like an alter ego?
Yeah.
Huh.
Just different persona, same character. But anyway, I'm curious. Shaiskov's parades. So many parades. Parades, parades, parades. Then Clevenger's trial. And then Arezzo mission. Colonel Nevers dies. So I think Hungry Joe. Yeah, okay. So this is where I think they've arrived. And then, yeah, Colonel Nevers has died. Ferreira mission. Kraft dies. Yes?
Right. And that's when Yusarian gets his medal.
Yeah, he gets his medal.
Mind you, it may not be then, because I think they did Avignon and Ferreira more than once.
Yeah, but no, the in terms of the missions, Ferreira was first. It's Bologna that was repeated. Bologna attempt one, bad weather.
Gotcha.
Yeah. The only attempt, so it kept raining, and then suddenly there was an epidemic of diarrhea and the bomb line that moved. So, So the manipulations and the dodginess. Event number 10, yeah, which is that Bologna attempt number 2, the bomb line, which is hilarious. Then you've got Bologna attempt number 3, food poisoning. And whether that was food poisoning, or if it was soap, it was soap. Event number 12 is the Egyptian cotton crop, yeah?
Yeah, so that, it's interesting thinking that chapter where Milo took Yusarian ore all around Europe and North Africa and the Middle East. That was the beginnings of his syndicate.
Yes, yeah. And that was after Bologna. So Mud is representative of... Yeah, so Mud was killed, I think. That was the next thing. Then it was the loyalty oath. Then you had Luciana. Then there was the hospital again. I think the missions have gone up. And that's where the missions went up as well. Then Avignon.
Avignon's when Snowden died, yes?
Yes. Yeah, Avignon is when Snowden died. And then there was the... Then he gets the medal ceremony for Ferreira, which happened before Avignon. So the sequence pretty much was Ferreira, Bologna, Avignon. Yeah?
Right. So it's like the whole time they were wondering what to do about the fact he went over twice.
Yeah.
And then it was only after he returned from Avignon that they decided to give him a medal.
I think they decided on doing that anyway. They decided after Ferreira. But for them to get it, go through the works, and remember they also wanted a promotion for him.
Hmm.
Yeah.
And so by the time it was time for him to get the medal, he did not want to wear clothes because of what happened to Snowden.
Exactly. So hospital. Now we have the hospital where he has the Washington Irving situation.
Right.
Yeah, so this is where he does the silly Washington Irving.
That's business. Where the book starts.
Yes. Then we go into the next one, which is Nurse Duckett. Yeah?
Mm.
And then... Then McWatt kills Kid Samson and commits suicide. And okay. Inadvertently... essentially causes Dr. Danica to die, even though he's not dead, but you know what I mean. And everyone knows. So then, hospital with Nate Leoseri and Dunbar, Hungry Joe, and the chaplain.
That's when Dunbar disappeared, wasn't it?
Well, first they're all in the hospital, and he finally got to have his Thanksgiving. Dobbs and Nate Lee are killed.
Hmm.
Cathcart raises the number of missions at the request of Milo. So it's missing some of the other stuff that happened.
That gives me a pretty good picture. I mean, to be honest, the only thing I was iffy about was, yeah, kind of the Avignon Ferreira order.
Yeah, the order of the attacks. Yeah, it's pretty hard, though. I know there's people that would have probably done this really well. I think someone probably has.
We just can't find it.
I know. Oh, my gosh. So I'm going to post this on the thingy, which is compositional rigor, Joseph Heller's organizational chart for Catch-22. I'm finding this and I'm putting it on our thing. Catch-22 organizational chart. Sorry. Catch-22 organizational chart. I mean, I'm going to find a source of it because it's really well done. It's so detailed. I can't even, I'm going to, so yeah, I'll put that on our thingy, but oof, oof. So this is how Heller did his thing.
Okay, let's have a, whoa.
Yeah.
Just open that up. Wow. Oh my God. Just in case no one actually wants to look it up for yourself, it's like four A4, maybe even larger than A4 pages, kind of stick together in this giant spreadsheet almost.
So yeah, he's. I think the expression someone said, there's a reading group contributor, Pal Freeman from the Guardian reading group, says, it's, if you think of the book as a helix, or the threading on a screw or a bolt, Heller keeps us circling back to seeming repetition of incidents and tropes and jokes until we get dizzy, but imperceptibly the screw goes forward. Even if you're turning it clockwise, the plot progresses so that at the end you understand they've been leading to it. I agree, yeah. That is really cool.
Mm.
It's a really, really clever kind of structure.
And I might have, there's a link to find a more legible version, because I'm kind of just looking at the overall
it's picture. huge. Oh wow, that's a nice one. I shall put it up. I'll put both of them up on our thing. Okay, so if we go chronology, we have the early 1944. Wow, and it goes across and it gives us the different characters as well.
I've often heard, you know, that As an author, you have to know your world down to the smallest detail, because, you know, you don't put all that stuff in the book, otherwise it would be boring. But you got to kind of know it to be able to tell your story and make the world believable.
It makes sense. And I think it's interesting here because it's gone through and it says, civilians enlistedment, so then a cadet, shipped overseas to Pianosa, Cathcart arrives and raises missions, Ferreira happens, Milo arrives and forms his cartel, Rome is captured, Bologna happens, then there's the missions are raised to 40 and then raised to 45 between Bologna and Avignon, then we have Avignon, then we have Snowden's funeral, Clevenger disappears in the cloud, Ysaren enters the hospital, Ysaren leaves the hospital, Ysaren tries to be grounded, tries to get help, missions raised again, Ysaren keeps flying, missions raised again, Ysaren wounded in the hospital or lost in combat. Whilst he's in the hospital, we know that was he was meant to be sent home, but they got all muddled.
Mm.
65 missions, Orr and Kid Samson. Orr is lost in combat. Then Kid Samson is killed. McQuart commits suicide. Dr. Nika is essentially dead on paper. Natalie gets his girl. Ysaren breaks Natalie's nose. Missions raised. Ysaren refuses, accepts Quorn's deal, goes AWOL, accepts Quorn's deal, gets stabbed in the hospital, he repudiates the deal, and then runs away when he hears Orr is safe. So that's a very simplified one.
Going back to thinking about the book as a whole, I have a question for you, Ru.
Yeah.
In your opinion, who is the most reprehensible character?
Oof. Milo is terrible. Arfi is terrible. But Quorn and Cathcart, I mean, Quorn arguably is the worst.
Just because of him being the power behind the throne, as it were. And
yeah.
And yeah, a lot of tension, well, a lot of all the misery in the book would have been alleviated if Cathcart hadn't kept raising missions.
Yeah, and Danica could have solved a lot of this. Danica really could have solved a lot of this.
Oh, by having a backbone.
Yep.
That seems to be kind of also a prevailing theme. Like, it came out, you know, in the final chapter that Danby really doesn't have the gall to stand up to anybody. The chaplain never had the gall to stand up to anybody.
No.
Danica never did.
Milo, and it's really hard. Between Milo, Arfi, Captain Black, and Colonel Quorn, pretty bad. Pretty dang bad. I'm trying to see if I can find the casualties, the notes. No, I'm trying to find the... Where are you? It's Clevenger. Clevenger argues that Ysirin has no right to save his own life. God, about that. I'm trying to find who it was that was... who did something that I was curious about what happened. Not the chaplain. I love how they haven't mentioned Major DeCoverley. He's just not even on this grid.
Hmm.
So it's Major Duluth. I want to see if I can find DeCoverley, but he just doesn't... We can't find him, so... he's in here somewhere. Oh, no. Okay, never mind. I cannot find what happened to Major DeCoverley, not according to this grid. This is a very helpful grid.
It's, yeah, there's quite a few characters that, like, their fates are, you know, kind of left all up in the open.
Well, they haven't been mentioned in here, but they are available in other spots.
We got a bit of closure on, like, you know, how both Cathcart and Wintergreen have now been made... Well, Wintergreen has been made a partner in Milo's enterprise, and he's promised Cathcart a job after the war.
Yeah, there's a lot of that kind of... Yeah, there's a lot going on where we kind of go, yeah, that sounds about right. That self-serving business.
Wintergreen's a very mysterious character.
He tried to stick to digging ditches so he wouldn't get killed. He knew what he was doing. He placed himself in a position so that he wasn't caught. Like, he wasn't at risk. He wouldn't be caught.
Mm.
So that was clever. I grudgingly agree that he is clever. But, you know.
So, final thoughts about the book. Do you have any overall impressions now that we're at the end of it?
There was a lot. It's a lot going on. A lot of moving parts.
Overwhelming, you'd say?
Yeah. So, one of the images that's come up when we look up Catch-22, sorry, because now we can't, because it's not going to be a spoiler now, is it? Was saying one of the Catch-22s, Catch-22, the logic of Catch-22 is a paradoxical situation from which an individual cannot escape because of the contradictory rules or limitations. The term was coined by Joseph Heller, who used it in his 1961 novel Catch-22. An example is, how can I get any experience until I get a job that gives me experience?
Yeah.
Which is a big one. So the logic was, do you want to get out of combat duty? Yes. Only the insane can, and wanting to get out is a proof of sanity. So, you have to keep on finding. Or, do you want to get out of combat duty? No, you have to keep on fighting. And of course, it means that you're insane, but you can't get out of combat.
Yeah.
Because for you to actually get sent, it needs to be identified. It's interesting. There's a catch. Anyone who wants to get out of combat duty isn't really crazy. All these things. They have a right to do anything we can't stop them from doing, which was the whole thing. It's a brutal, it's an operation of power, that makes sense. Yeah. But yeah, it's a massive commentary on a lot of stuff. In the U.S. particularly, but not restricted to the U.S.
Mm.
It's military and government, and when you, again, much like with our previous dystopian novels, when you treat humans as a means to an end.
You think this counts as a dystopic novel?
Yes. It's yes and no. It's dystopic in the sense that it is describing a scenario that is unfortunately an ingrained cultural accepted norm. It's a military norm. It is a military consuming, like, government having complete control kind of situation, like, where people are treated as a commodity.
And look, I'll just say, yeah, what went down in World War II, that's definitely a dystopia.
It's. So pretty much, yes, it is dystopian. It is handling it with a really dark humor.
Mm-hmm.
And the absurdism, I see what you mean. That absurdist kind of humor, absolutely. I will say it still reminds me of MASH. I know that hasn't been your thing, but it reminds me of MASH a lot.
Mm.
And that one varies, some episodes more so than others. Some have aged well, some have absolutely not.
Yeah.
But the topics they handle include things like the way we treat, that no one really wants combat. No one, we've said this before, no one who has an understanding about and cares about human beings and sees each other as human beings, regardless of background or ideologies or whatever, wants to be in a state of combat.
Mm.
Those who seek, actively long for that kind of situation are probably, have not, like, there's usually a reason for it.
And I think they're a lot rarer than we tend to think about.
Yeah.
I think Havermeyers are rare.
Yes, yes. I think that there's reasons that those people are generated. Amongst other things, you've got the ones like Applebee's who blindly follow this as well, the flies in the eyes.
And I also just want to point out that the last time we saw Havermeyer, he came out to see Yossarian in the night when Yossarian was refusing to fly and had quite a... I'm trying to think of the right word.
I think
level conversation with him. We could tell that he's not too bright, but...
It's more also, he said, look, I know we don't get along. I get it. We're never going to get along, kind of thing. But even Havermeyer has had enough.
Mm.
He's been shaken, which is, yeah...
He was able to realize, even like if Yossarian would take a deal to fly milk runs, it's like, well, that's a lousy deal because then the rest of us have to fly the dangerous missions.
And he's over it. There's a certain level of it that he's also over. And I think that when you've got people like Havermeyer and Appleby coming to him,
yeah,
that's telling you just how miserable. I think part of it would have also been Milo's bombing of that they are being treated as just a means to an end for a handful to succeed.
And you pointed out at the time, I think, that the term milk run is kind of a misnomer because while they should be easy, a lot of people have died on these milk runs.
Yes, and a lot of the time it was because information was being provided to the enemy. That's another thing. I wonder if that was referring to Captain Black.
I mean, could be, but in all instances when we had that, I went right to Milo in my head.
I mean, Milo, yes. Milo is the main person that I think of. But I think Captain Black also, because he's like, why are we fighting those who espouse American ideals, like in Nazi Germany? I'm going, wow.
Yeah.
Technically they did model their approaches and attitudes and everything. Yeah. Anyway, it was pretty bad.
Black's a piece of work, but yeah, I don't know if he's a traitor.
I don't know.
But you know, the funny thing using that word, even though Milo is definitely a traitor, because he's a capitalist before anything, that he would be offended by that notion.
Well, he's a profiteer.
Yeah.
He is an extreme profiteer, which is a very much, people have described Milo as a caricature of...
He's not really a caricature.
He's meant to be a caricature of extreme capitalist ideologies. And at the same time, I mean, and by the way, let's not go down the whole capitalist communist debate business here. It's just... He's being used as an instrument, as a character, to really point out that when you take a lot of the time, that's what is also happening in war.
Yep.
There's profiteering, there's propaganda.
Profit above all else, and the country lines don't mean anything.
Yeah. Yeah. I have no problem with country lines meaning nothing, but when there's combat, to be treating humans as completely, you know... The human cost and outcomes and impact, the fact that you fed them all cotton.
Yeah.
And, anyway, so it's a real mess. So, yes. Excellent.
Well, I guess that's the end of Catch-22. So, because it's the end of one book, obviously we're going to start another. I think it's time.
Drum roll. I don't know if that's going to get you kept in, but you know. So drum roll. We are going to be doing A Wrinkle in Time by Madeleine Leng, and I can't pronounce her surname. And I apologize to anyone who's a French speaker. It's just not going to happen. Madeleine Leng. And it is... It's like an adolescent, more children's novel. There is a Disney movie. If you've seen the Disney movie, the books are slightly... I mean, the book is slightly different as we're seeing. I mean, I don't mind the Disney movie. I enjoyed it. But at the same time... it is both a coincidence and not a coincidence that that I keep picking books that have been made into media, because they're books that tend to have the ability to be shared, or stories that can be told and have like an almost continuous value to them. I like the eternal storytelling kind of thing. Same way that Shakespeare stories are always somehow topical, or... Yeah, I mean, Anne of Green Gables has a certain eternal nature to it that you can keep retelling it and retelling it and retelling it. Same with most of Austen's work or others. So we'll get into Wrinkle in Time and try and avoid spoiling yourself with watching the movie.
I have never read the book and I've never seen any of the films, so I'm definitely going to keep my tunnel vision right to the slow chapter after chapter unfolding of our podcast. Yeah.
It's not as long a book as many of our other books have been, so this is a... I don't think it's a very long book from memory. But the concepts might be. I don't think it is a long book from memory. It's not that...
416 pages, so it's about the same as a lot of the others we've read.
It is. So page number wise, it should be about the same. But in terms of content, there are moments that flow very fast.
The book's got a quick pace to it.
Some parts, yes. Some parts are layered and take a bit of time, and they might require some untangling. There is a section which I have to probably verbally describe, because it's described in the book. And in the book, they tend to, just like in The Little Prince, you know, how there's a little illustration. In some editions of the book, they have an illustration to go with it to try and explain it, because it's a concept that can be a bit tangly, brain tangly, but you shouldn't need a visual to look it up. It should be fine without the visual.
Okay.
Otherwise, we will tweet it. However, overall, there are some... We won't have the really nasty, darker sides of humanity in terms of the explicit nasty stuff that we've been having in Catch-22, not going to happen. So don't worry about that. There are other themes that could be a little bit challenging. However, overall, I think it's kind of a bit of a more relaxed kind of pace. It's a challenging book because it makes you kind of think about concepts that you haven't. And I like the fact that it's a children's book or an adolescent book, young reader's book, that doesn't treat the reader as someone who can't understand concepts that are hard. So it doesn't talk down to you, the reader. It tries to make things easier to grapple with, but the topics themselves are not small topics. They're pretty big concepts.
Oh, cool.
So yeah. Yeah.
Well, I'm looking forward to this.
Yeah.
So yeah, we now have reached the end of our fifth book. We thank you for joining us, especially if you've been here the whole of Catch-22. Please let us know how you enjoyed the podcast, how you enjoyed the book. We'd love to hear from you. But let's get to the wrap-up. The music at the front of the podcast for the final time is Soap Runs. It's by Rupert Gregson-Williams and Harry Gregson-Williams. You know, the final episode of every book, I always feel wistful to say goodbye to the intro music that I've grown so fond of by editing these episodes every week. it's like an old friend, and you have to wave bye-bye sometimes. But we always have the music at the end of the podcast, which is I'm the Slime by Frank Zappa. You can find me over on Twitter at Dave_the_turnip.
And you can find me at Rue McMoo on Twitter. You can also find our podcast at SMBSLT Podcast. That's on Twitter. on Facebook. And if you add @gmail.com, you get our email address. And we welcome correspondence and feedback from you, ideas. What are your feelings upon our upcoming book? What are your feelings about the previous books we've covered? Anytime. Welcome.
Indeed. But until next episode with the new book, we hope you're enjoying your reading. We hope you're staying safe, and we'll see you next time.